Hi, my name's Rachel, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rachel.
Oh, my. I wasn't nervous till now. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Hilltop Group in North Garden, Virginia. It's a new meeting. We meet on Thursday nights at 6 p.m. I guess the meeting's been around maybe a year and a half or maybe 2 years now. And I love it because it's 5 minutes from my house. And my sobriety date is September 21st, 1988, which amazes me. And it is a one-day-at-a-time program. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now is always a good framework for this, the way to do this. I am Canadian by birth, and I lived in Ontario until I was 14 years old with my family. My dad's a minister. My mom is a housewife, and I have four siblings, and my brother's the oldest, and I have three sisters, and I'm the second youngest. So that was sort of the family. And there was no alcohol in my upbringing, period. I was in a denomination of Mormon faith, not the Utah Mormons, but there's another group that's based in Missouri. And that was the church that I grew up in. So there was no drinking, no smoking, and when I was younger, no dancing. So they loosened up on that in the 60s. So I'm never embarrassed about my age. I do look younger than I am, and I just feel blessed by that. But I was born in 1955. I just like people to kind of know, you know, the time frame that I was coming up in. So I had this really quite a good family upbringing. I never witnessed anybody drinking. I had a church that was entirely family-based, family activities. I went to, my dad was he was a draftsman. What was he when I was born? He might have been he was a draftsman when I was born. He had an 11th grade education, and then he went back, he got into this program where he could become a teacher. And he was a shop teacher. And then he decided to become a minister. So when I was 9, he became a minister. And we moved to another town, which was fine. I mean, the whole thing in Canada was fine. You know, I had a good upbringing. I didn't witness alcohol in any shape or form. And I am the only person in my family who's an alcoholic of my siblings that I know of. And part of that might be, they may be alcoholics, but that because of the church, they never have had a drop of alcohol. So they don't know what it does to their bodies. I went off to the church college. Well, okay, back up a little bit. So when I was 14, we moved from Hamilton, Ontario, which is Canada's Pittsburgh. It's a steel city. It's on Lake Ontario. It's a working man's, you know, blue-collar town. And when I was 9, we moved to Chatham, Ontario, which is like Madison. You know, it was rural, although it's flat, completely flat. Rural, sugar beets, corn, you know, and I loved it. It was a small city. It's actually a small city. It's about 30,000 people. I felt really safe there. I could get on the city bus and, you know, just do anything. And just, it was a very safe environment. And in 1969, my dad accepted a position to be a regional executive for the church for the Northeast, the Atlantic region. And we moved to New Jersey. And we moved, you know, right outside of New York City, in Ridgewood, New Jersey. which, if anybody knows, Ridgewood, it's a very wealthy community. And we lived in the parish house there. And we were just not wealthy people at all. And it was just such a culture shock. My graduation from high school, all the girls wore white gowns and carried a dozen red roses, and an Auchincloss or Kennedy did the, it was just, I was a fish out of water. And I was really quite unhappy. But I still didn't drink because I had this church environment. And then one thing, I'm always interested how my higher power chooses for me to tell this story because it's always different, and we'll see where it goes. But it'll all come together here. So I was in New Jersey, and I graduated from high school, and I went to the church college. The thing I should maybe mention is that when we moved from Canada, what had been a really nice family environment was that my my older brother was draft age, and the draft was very much alive then, and they do draft permanent residents, so he didn't move with us. My older sister was in was just entering grade 13, which of course you guys don't have a grade 13, so she was sent to the church college in Iowa. So what was this big family became me and my older, the three younger siblings, and we lost our family leadership as far as the kids were, because those two older siblings were like our leaders and made me feel safe and created a lot of the fun. And then my mother was also very depressed with the move. It was a really hard adjustment for all of us, except my dad, who loved what he was doing, and he traveled a lot. So I graduated from high school and I went to the church college, just because I really didn't know anything else to do. And I didn't feel like I had a choice. That was my parents. I mean, the church was our lives and that's just what you did. All my siblings except my brother went to the church college. And another twist in here is that my sister, who's 2 years older than I, was put back a year in seventh grade. She was held in seventh grade, and I had skipped a year. So from seventh grade on, we were like sort of like twins, but we weren't. And it was not fun. And she was not outgoing. She was very introverted, and I felt like I kind of had to take care of her. It was a weird twist of the way the way I thought it should be. It was an unusual situation to be in. So we graduated and we went off to college together, and then. So here I am at school, 1972, and someone offers me a joint, and I smoke it, and I pretty much became a daily marijuana smoker from that. And I was never going to drink because I was an artist, I was a writer, and I wasn't, the jocks drank, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that scene at all. But I'm also Canadian, so. In January, I went on a date with this hockey player, and he's from Edmonton, and he was a hockey player, and I just thought it was great, and we shared a bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine. I'm at this party, and I'm sitting in his lap, and he was a real hockey player because he didn't have teeth, but he had teeth he could take in and out, which was a nice party trick. So, and his name was Bongo, And he said that if someone addressed a letter to him from Edmonton and just put Bongo 50140, it would make it to him, and it did. I mean, that's how. I mean, the church college was in this small town, in Lamoni, Iowa, really small town. I remember that so clearly as most. I think it's one of the questions that we could probably ask people is, how do you remember your first drink? You know, how do you remember your first drink? And I remember it as a wonderful experience of feeling comfortable, flirtatious. I felt adored by this guy. I felt like I could speak. I was a very shy introvert, very quiet, and it gave me a voice. But I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I didn't know that when I took that first drink, that it ignited this desire in me to drink more. And basically that first 9 months, or six, I started drinking in January. I was 17 years old. I would belly up to the bar, the one bar in town. All you could buy was beer. I would, I was staying off campus a lot, and I had a hard time passing the bar to get to classes. And a draft cost a quarter. And even back then, you know, a pack of cigarettes was 40 cents. And, you know, even back then, a quarter was nothing. You know, who didn't have a quarter in their pocket? And they served me for a while, and then at some point they checked the school records and found out I was 18 was the age, and they found out I was 17, and they stopped serving me. But I just drank as much as I could, whenever I could, till I threw up, passed out. I had evenings when people had to carry me home. I had days when people had to... daytimes when people had to carry me home. I had deans stopping me and asking me if I was okay. I wish I could say it was fun and games for me, but really that there were some good times, but most of the time I was just really depressed, and I became suicidal. I have to say, it was the one time in my life when I just drank as much as I wanted to. And being an alcoholic, that was like, as much, you know, whenever. By the end of the summer, I found myself pregnant by a married man who was quite a bit older than me. And I've worked with his mother in the cafeteria, and at one time I'd worked with his mother in the cafeteria, and I also worked with his wife on the lawn crew. So that's kind of where my drinking took me. And I tried to kill myself when I realized I was pregnant. So I'm in this small town in Iowa. I've been drinking, and I've taken an overdose of aspirin. And the man, his wife is out of town, so I'm at his house. He calls the doctor. The small town doctor says, tell her she's crazy. And that was the extent of the help I got. And, you know, today I was thinking about this, and I said, I don't know if he actually really even called the doctor. Yeah, I don't know. He could have just said that, you know. And then he left me. And it was a very, very long night where I hallucinated, and I had a lot of ear ringing in my ears, because aspirin will do that to you. And my oldest sister was married and still at the church college and had her own apartment with her husband, and I walked over to her place. And my parents had moved to Independence, Missouri, so I told her that what had happened. And I didn't tell her I was pregnant. I just told her what had happened and that I wanted, and she drove me down to our folks, and I asked my parents for help. And they didn't believe in counseling or anything like that. I mean, I was ripe at 18. I had just turned 18. I was ripe for AA. I really was. It was a bottom. I hated myself. I didn't like what I was doing. I was ashamed. And so I didn't tell them I was pregnant either. But I just have to pull myself up by my own bootstraps, and thus began 15 years of controlled drinking, with more or less success. I dropped out of school. I had an abortion. I moved in with my folks. I worked as a car hop, probably the last car hop job in the United States. I had made rules for myself, which was I was going to be self-supporting in my drinking. I was not going to, because before I depended on men for a lot of my drinking, and I was going to, you know, pay my own way, and that way I could have some self-respect. And so I did that. I was still like a daily marijuana user for about 7 years. So along with my drinking, and other, you know, I just sort of experiment a lot of things. So the controlled drinking. I've been married since 1977 to the same man, and we're very happily married, thanks to this program. He is not an alcoholic. I met him when I was 15 years old, and we started, he actually came to my high school. He lived in Maryland, and I lived in New Jersey. We had met at a church event. He came to my high school graduation. We corresponded. I broke his heart. When I left school, I got in touch with him again, and we started talking on the phone, and I ended up moving east to be with him. And I moved to Rockville, Maryland, and we lived together for 3 years, and then we got married and had a kid, and we moved to North Garden. Actually, we moved to Charlottesville first, and then we found we have a little cabin in North Garden. So it's rural there. Whoever told me I'm a city folk, it was rural, although it's getting more built up all the time. And I was a mom. I had three kids. When I moved to Charlottesville, during the 3 years before I was married, I worked at Sears Roebuck as a collection correspondent, which meant I was on the phone trying to collect debt, which was a really fun job. And one of my co-correspondents was a cocaine dealer. And so I fell in with him and cheated on my boyfriend at the time. And this guy supported me I was still living with my future husband, but this other guy supported me in a cocaine addiction for a year. And I then my boyfriend confronted me about the relationship. And this was my thinking at the time. My thinking was, and this was actually the way I was raised too, you know, is a man is what's going to complete me. So I'm looking at this one guy, and I'm looking at Danny, and I'm going, drug addict, reliable person, you know, all the drugs I want, I'll probably live longer. and in a way, I chose life that I thought, that's when we decided to get married. It was just like coming out of that thing and get married. That was the solution. There was no thought of me ever, like, living on my own, trying to support myself, have my own career, anything like that. And then we had our first child, like, a year after we were married. So I come down to Charlottesville, and it's going to be a fresh start. I just know it. I have this baby. I'm a mother now. I want to stop smoking pot, so I won't have the connections. I would say at the time I wasn't thinking so much about drinking. You know, I was drinking some, but not lots. I didn't drink when I was. That's not true. I was drinking. I remember my mom came when my first son was born, and she always stayed 2 weeks after each child was born, and that was wonderful. But after the first one, when she was gone, as soon as she left, I went to my neighbor's apartment upstairs, you know, and I was a bong in one hand and a beer in the other. I mean, I just couldn't wait. And I wasn't the best at the nighttime attention for my child. And thank goodness my husband was not what was a responsible person and would hear the baby cry and would get up for the baby. So we moved down here, and it was going to be a fresh start. And I went to a yoga class. I lived in Four Seasons, and at the time there was a YMCA there, and I had yoga class, and I took this yoga class, and I met a woman there, and she had a kid the same age, and I invited her over for lunch, and she came over to my apartment for lunch, and she about the first words out of her mouth were, "Do you smoke pot?" And I was just like, oh, I was so, I mean, my heart just dropped. And I was like, is it on my forehead? Well, you know, I mean, you know who the stoners are. I mean, yeah. And it's pretty obvious. And I started, you know, smoking pot, and it's like, I don't want to do this. I got involved in a spiritual group. I got involved in the Sufi order, and I did the Sufi dancing, and I was initiated as a Sufi, later that spring, we moved into January, and January 79, and that spring, so I was doing yoga, and I was doing this Sufi thing, and I became a member of that group. It was a very small group in Charlottesville, and the Sufi order had one rule, and that was that you don't use hallucinogenic drugs, which included marijuana, and I'm so grateful to them, because they got me out of my daily. I stopped smoking pot, and for 3 years, I didn't drink either, even though that wasn't part of the thing. But people weren't drinking. People were living pretty cleanly, and so it just wasn't part of what, I guess it became a substitute for my church. But after my second, so I was, you know, off and on, I've had these depressive bouts. And after my second child was born, I think I had a little bit of postpartum depression. And my Sufi teacher said, you know, you're just, I stayed home with my kids for like 8 years. So she said, I think that you need to get out and you know, go out with your husband. You know, you guys should have a date night and just go out and have a glass of wine. And it was that same sinking feeling. It's like, you don't know me, you know, and like this angel on that old thing, the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, and the angel saying, don't drink, and the devil saying, yay, permission. So we went out, and I had several glasses of wine, and as typically when we went out, my husband would have to stop several times as we were driving home for me to open the car door and throw up. That's the way I drank. there wasn't anything really social about my drinking. Towards the end, my third son was conceived when I was on a binge, and I wasn't real happy about it, but I came to accept it, and he's you know, I mean, it didn't take long to accept it. My kids are all something else. That's what I can say about my kids. It's a family disease. That's what I can say about my kids. so So after my third son was born, I started a little preschool in my home, and I was actually doing quite well with it. And it is one of my regrets that I chose to give that up, and I became a postal worker for the money. And my husband's a postal worker. He just retired. So my youngest was 17 months old, and I went to work for the post office, the main office down in Charlottesville. And I worked really hard. They worked you really hard at the beginning. And you work long days, overtime, 6 days a week. Christmases are hell. I'm grateful every December that I don't work for the post office. And my husband and I would do this tag team. I worked evening shift. He worked day shift. And we'd switch off with the kids and when I bring the kids in. And I did that for 5 years. But the first, at the beginning, I went out with the guys after work. And I partied with the guys. And once in a while, there'd be another woman. At, 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would stumble home, I would drive home, pray my husband wasn't awake, that I could just sort of slide into bed without him noticing how drunk I was, and he'd get up and go to work, and I'd get up with a couple hours of sleep and hungover and do what I need to do for the kids. And that went on for a couple of years. And I was getting fatter and fatter. And I lost a lot of weight. And I wasn't eating. I was drinking. And I always say I never drank at home. I mean, I did drink at home, but I mean, I said I never drank at work. That was a lie I told myself because I always had a little pint in my locker. Not that I drank out of it, but it was there, which is illegal, by the way, on federal property. and then at Christmas time, out of the 70 people I worked with, the drunks, the 5 or 6 of us, would spike our Cokes and stuff so that we'd be drinking. Because, when you live at the post office, you certainly deserve to drink there because you don't have any time anywhere else to drink. So it was May of 1988, and I went to Kite Day up on Browns Mountain. And I thought I had made it in Charlottesville Society or something, because I got this invitation to go up there. And with my kids, it was a kid thing, I didn't drink. I had a little bit of a cold, and it was a very dank, dreary, rainy, actually, day, drizzly day. And I got sick. And then I got sicker. And then my mother-in-law came down to help with the kids. And then I refused to go to the doctor. I just had this feeling that it would go its course, and I was very anti-medical. And I lost the feeling in my legs, and that's when I went to the emergency room, and I had pneumonia. I had near-fatal pneumonia. I refused to be admitted, and the doctor said, okay, if you promise me, I don't know why they say these things, I mean, who's going to follow up? But he said, if you promise me that you will take these pills, and he gave me antibiotics, which were like this big, and you will stay in bed for a month, I will let you go home. And that's what I did. I totally relied on my husband, my mother-in-law, to take care of the kids. I stayed in bed for a month. And what's remarkable to me is I am a writer, and I've always kept journals off and on. And when I was about 2 years sober, I was going through some old stuff I'd written, and I found a journal from that month. And in that journal, I wrote, when I am better, I am going to get my drinking under control. And if you'd asked me at the time if I had a drinking problem, I would have told you no. No. I didn't drink for that month. I was too sick. I went back to work half-time for a couple of weeks, went back to work then full-time. And by August, I hit my bottom. When I started drinking again, which was about, 8 weeks after I'd come down with the pneumonia, I was drinking more than I was drinking than before I had the pneumonia. I mean, the progressiveness was really obvious to me. I had a lot of little red flags along the way. The May before I had pneumonia, my best friend had gone to Mountainwood, one of my best friends. She'd gone into treatment. So I was learning a little bit about alcoholism from her. We didn't, it's interesting, we were mothers together, we took care of our kids, we did school activities, we did, things together, but we never drank together. And she hid her drinking, so I was a little surprised, but she drank all the time, and I was doing this binge stuff. So anyway, she was in Mountainwood, and we were good friends, and I would talk to her, and she was telling me things like halt, because I was terribly sad. I was terribly sad and lonely. And she was reading me meditations out of recovery meditation books, and I was like, this is great stuff. And during this time, I was having an affair with a coworker, which is always fun when your husband works in the same place. And I just said I had to quit this because it just wasn't right. And my other best friend, she gave me, at that time, she gave me a big book. I confessed to her what was going on. She gave me a big book. And I, the third edition. And I took it home and I read it all the way through. And I thought, this is really interesting. If I know anybody who has a drinking problem, I will give them this book. Denial is really wonderful, I mean, it just keeps you feeling good about yourself. But I'd read it, and I've read some things in it. The same friend, who's still my best female friend, we've kept our relationship through everything. She lives in Arizona now. At the time, she was dating an alcohol counselor. And I went to her house. This was a little later in the spring. And I was concerned about this man that I was having an affair with because he was clearly an alcoholic. And I wanted to ask this guy questions about alcoholism. And he said, well, the first thing you need to know, it's progressive. It never gets better. It only gets worse. Actually, I can't remember what else he said, but I did remember that. So my last drunk, when I drove drunk home to my husband who was not happy, I had spent the night with two guys that had called him and said, she's here, she's too drunk to drive. He wasn't happy. And he said, I don't know what you're going to do, but you got to do something. And he left for work, and it was summer, the kids were not in school. I had these three boys. And I put the one had a play date. The youngest had a play date, and they were three, let me see, they would have been 3, 7, and 10. And the older two could play. They were good playmates. So they could play, and Danny went off to work, and I got in my bedroom, and I closed the door, and I kneeled down next to my bed. And my prayer was, I don't want to drink anymore. That was it. It was a heartfelt prayer. I'm going to cry. So I had an amazing feeling of calm come over me, that everything was going to be okay. I had a Bible next to my bed. All my life I've been a spiritual seeker. I told you about the Sufi thing, which lasted a while. But And so I had this Bible by my bed, and I opened it up, and it opened up to the last proverb, which is the thing about the good woman, you know, and which is rather controversial, I guess. But anyway, that proverb gave me so much hope that I could be a woman of dignity. I felt like that's what my God was saying to me, that I could be a woman of dignity. And the other impression I was given was that it was going to be work. So a few days before my last drunk, I had gone I'd come home from work or something, and it was daytime. And I had gone through our back door, and literally at the threshold, the dark mud room here, and the sunshine on my back. And I just thought, I cannot go on. I am just a shell of a person. There's nothing here. And I told my husband I thought I was going crazy, and that I should probably get some counseling or something. So I did. I made an appointment for the counselor. But she couldn't see me, and we were leaving for vacation. I had my last drunk the day before we went to vacation, and, like, that's another whole story of, like, in sobriety about me going on vacations and why I would always get plastered and delay the vacation a day. So I went off on this vacation after this prayer and feeling it would be okay, and I knew about AA because my friend had been going to these meetings, like, every day, which was, like, a little ridiculous as far as I was concerned. And I didn't drink for the 2 weeks we were on vacation. My brother, ex-outlaw, I should say, because my sister-in-law was not married to him, would, you know, we used to drink on vacations, and he carried cases of beer out of the vacation house at the end because I wasn't drinking. And I was just in this safe, sort of protected place, and I felt really hopeful. And I went, when I got home, and I went to the counselor, and I told her I was an alcoholic. She left the room for a minute, and she went and got a meeting list, and she came back. So if you think you're PCP people, someone gave her that meeting list. Or cooperation professional community. She brought the meeting list. She said, do you need, I can find someone who will take you to your first meeting if you want. And I said, no, that's fine, I'd go myself. And I went to St. Paul's Church on Thursday night at 8 o'clock. At that time, it was a big meeting. Still smoking. They used to bring a van in or bus in with the people from Mountain Wood, from the treatment center. You know, I felt a lot of hope at that meeting. I felt a lot of hope. So I've been going to meetings ever since. And recovery, for me, has been gradual. It's been slow. It's been steady. It's been wonderful. It's life, however, has been very difficult at times. It's been very good at times. I've been very happy. I was present for my children. I love AA. I mean, AA gave me a life worth living. I heard about the steps at meetings. It took me over 2 years to do my first fourth step. And if I'd known how much it was going to change my life, I would have done it earlier. After I did that fourth step, I felt like I kind of got it. And I got you guys, and I was one of you. Before that, I think I was just kind of on the fringes. I didn't really know what people... They had what I wanted. And I didn't realize that maybe it was the clarity and the forgiveness that a fourth and fifth step gives you. So that, you know, I have worked all the steps and I keep working them. I just finished another fourth and fifth last Sunday. And it's another freedom. What this program does is just keeps giving me freedom. I just have a few minutes left. When I was 7 years sober, I had surgery on my ears. I'm actually going to have a little minor surgery in a couple of weeks, which reminded me kind of the surgery. It's nothing, but I actually have the anesthesia, which kind of blows my mind. But I had tympanoplasty, which is an eardrum replacement, probably punctured from that aspirin overdose. I had chronic ear problems for years and years and years, and it took them forever to diagnose it. And I mean, I really did. Forever, I had ear infections all the time. So they fixed the eardrum, and because I had been on narcotics, it was suggested that I do 90 meetings in 90 days. So my kids were older now, and I could actually do that. I mean, I wasn't able to do that when they were young. And I did 90 meetings in 90 days, and I loved it. I really felt plugged into the program. You know, you meet a lot of people, and I went to Richmond to meetings and all this stuff. And then Easter Sunday that year, it was 1996, also in sobriety, I did things that I always dreamed of doing. And one of the things I did was I played guitar, and I'm a songwriter and a folk singer, and I didn't do that when I was drinking. I did that when I was sober, and I had performed the night before Easter, and I was feeling really good about the performance, and I thought I'm just happy in the direction where my life is going. And then on Easter Sunday, my middle son, Kay, came down, and he was jumping on my bed, and he said, he was big to be jumping on my bed, but he was 14 years old, and he pulled up his pant leg, and I said, "Mom, I think there's something really wrong." And he had this red welt on his leg. And I said, maybe it's a stress fracture. And I know what your doctor would say, so let's just go to the emergency room. It's Sunday. Let's get an x-ray, and at least he'll have that information tomorrow. And we went to the emergency room, and, you know, just me and him. Didn't seem like a big deal. My husband's home with the other kids. And he had osteosarcoma. He had cancer, which they can diagnose from one x-ray, which astounded me, but it's true. And that began the next journey of being present for him and the last 2 years of his life, or 19 months. And, you know, I don't know how I would have done that without this program. I know my first reaction, which always proves to me that I am a true alcoholic, is that when they told us, actually when we went to UVA to like confirm all this stuff and get an oncologist, I thought, oh good, now I can drink. This is a big enough reason to drink. And my second thought was, if I drink, I won't be there for him. So, and that's the only time in that whole ordeal that I thought about drinking. You know, I kept going to meetings when I could. People in AA were amazingly supportive. Our whole community held us. There's a lot of power and, you know, collective, everybody's higher powers supporting us in every way. I stopped work. I had stopped working at the post office some time before. That's another story. But, you know, but I was doing a bunch of little jobs and trying to be a musician. And so I stopped doing everything to take care of him. And it was a real gift to be with him and really get to know him. And he passed when he was 16. And then it became hard. And I did want to drink again. Actually, 5 years after he passed, I had a real crisis of faith. And for the very reason of if a higher power could do this, how can I believe in a higher power? And I had to recalibrate everything. And I just kind of went through my own dark night of the soul. But came through. And came through with doing the steps again. Doing the steps, I've done a thorough four-step for this last time was my fourth time of a really thorough four-step, and it's changed my life every time. So, yeah. So, what I could say is about that first four-step. You know, I would refuse medical care when I had pneumonia. And I had all my children at home. I was anti-medical. I just thought doctors are out to screw you of your money. That was my belief. And that was on my fourth step, my first fourth step. And what happened is I got right relationship with the medical community. So that when my son got sick, I wasn't fighting the medical community. I was cooperating. We were a team. They loved us. I mean, they loved us because we were open-minded and not fighting. And he just got the best care. And, you know, there was a guy in AA. I haven't seen him in years, but at the time he was in AA, and he was one of the custodians there. And one day that he was cleaning our room, and I was giving him a hug, and the doctor came in, and the doctor's like, "How do you know that guy?" I was like, "Yeah, that's okay." mutual friends, yeah. But so yeah, and like there are AA angels everywhere. I mean, at the time, Danny B was on his pediatric rotation, and he's a I watched him get sober and become a doctor, and then he turns out to be one of my son's doctors. Yeah. Yeah. And so you know, we're all over the place in that hospital. So, yeah. So being in right relationship with the medical community was extremely valuable. You never know what your fourth step's going to do for you. Last year was really difficult. Nothing like having a child die. But I told you I live in the country. We have almost 2 acres of land. We bought a little log cabin that we have gradually, over the years, put appendages on. It's really too big for us now, but you know, it's our home. We like it. It's unique. It's like our personality. And we have almost 2 acres of land, and over 30 years that we've lived there, there was a large landowner that owned all the land around us, and he passed away 4 years ago, and the land was, they tried to sell it in one piece, and they didn't. They sold two large pieces, and those people are really cool, good stewards of the land. And then I guess his son, who lives in Colorado, got tired of owning this 4 acres, 100 acres for 4 years that he'd been trying to sell. So what he did was clear cut the woods. So this is 100 acres that my kids grew up. The owner allowed us to play. Our kids grew up playing in it. I walked in it. It was my higher power. That was really difficult. I mean, I was sharing with Christine when we were driving up here. It was like this weekend a year ago. Just a normal weekend. I'm washing the dishes, and the trees are falling down. No warning, no idea that this was going to happen. And then not knowing what was happening. It put me in a post-traumatic stress situation. It really, really did. And, you know, so it's the land, the clear cut. It's totally changed my landscape. It's going to be developed. It's going to be low density. It's going to be high-end housing, you know. But this was the vast majority of my four-step, is my resentments at this guy, at my future neighbors that I don't even know yet, you know, at the developer, you know, it's just like this whole thing. And then I also have two alcoholic children who aren't drinking, but aren't really doing anything else, you know, and they're very difficult. And so they're on there a lot. But this morning when I woke up, because for the past year, and particularly since they stopped the logging, I have to tell you, when they log, they do it really well ecologically, but they would chip everything that they didn't take out, all the branches, and they staged the chipper about 60 feet from our property line. This is a commercial chipper. I don't know if you know how noisy that is. And they would start at 7 in the morning till 4:30 every day, 6 days a week. And I was driven from my home for the duration of the act of logging, you know, from January to, it was mid-April, I think, when they stopped. And then, you know, how I've been living is resentful when I wake up in the morning because I can see the goddamn sun coming up. Resentful at night because I can see the lights of Charlottesville. Resentful when I drive down my road because it's not shady anymore. You know, this is how I'm living. And resentful of these people I don't even know yet. So I have to say the past week has been a relief. And this morning when I woke up, I lay in bed. It was about 7 o'clock. And I said, I wonder how long it'll take the sun to rise. And I just lay there. There wasn't a sunrise, actually. But I lay there just watching the light change and anticipating the sunrise and the beauty and not resenting. You know, just loving the space I have, what I have today. I mean, because really that's all we have anyway, is today. And I think that's a good place for me to stop. Thanks.